Go ahead.
May it please the court. David McNeil was convicted of burglary in the second degree and stealing after a jury trial and sentenced as a persistent offender to 10 years in prison and 150 days jail time, respectively, on those two counts. He entered into an apartment, specifically number apartment 510, within an apartment complex in St. Louis and stole a drill. He fully admitted to stealing a drill at trial and, in fact, indicated that he had tried or wanted to plead guilty to stealing before trial. The evidence showed that next door to apartment 510, where the drill was stolen, in apartment 511, the mother of his son lived. He said he knew the tenant of apartment 510, Tracy, didn't know her last name, but he was acquainted with her from visiting apartment 511. On the day he stole the drill, he said he walked to the apartment because Tracy owed him $10 from a month before. He knocked on the door. When he didn't receive a response, he entered the door and walked in. In a subsequent post-conviction motion, he alleged his attorney was ineffective for not at least requesting that the jurors at his trial consider trespass in the first degree as a lesser included instruction for the burglary second degree. The amended motion was denied, the motion court concluding that he had failed to meet Strickland's performance and prejudice prongs. Getting to the issues.
In regard to the prejudice prong, since the jury found him guilty of the more serious offense, and the law is they're presumed to follow the instructions, how could you ever prove prejudice?
That's the state's argument, and I think that's a misreading of Strickland. I think Strickland's...
That reading's been accepted by the state Supreme Courts and other states, though, correct?
Well, it's
the principle makes sense to you, doesn't it, that the jury's presumed to follow the instructions?
Well, the principle doesn't make... It makes sense if you're in Florida, because... I guess the state's arguing based on that principle that Strickland, the plain language of Strickland, precludes you from speculating about what the jury would have done.
Well, and the law in Missouri is pretty lenient in the giving of a lesser included offenses, because the jury's presumed to be able to agree, to believe or disbelieve all, none, or part of the testimony of any witness. So in this case, there's no doubt he would have gotten the lesser included offense instruction. But doesn't that same presumption that they could believe all, part, or none of the testimony cut against you, because they obviously believed the evidence that he committed the higher offense?
Well, we're arguing that we are speculating about had a lesser included instruction.
Well, but we don't have to speculate, because they were entitled to believe all, part, or none of it.
Well, they weren't.
And you're suggesting, well, they could have believed this part of it, but we know they didn't, because they found him guilty of the higher crime.
We don't know what they would have done had they been instructed on trespass in the first degree. In fact, they sent a note to the judge.
How does that make sense? Because if they would have believed him, then they should have found him not guilty of the higher offense. And that's the reason, quite honestly, why it's a strategic matter. But I'm not putting that burden on you. I'm giving you, for the benefit of our discussion, the fact that the judge would have had to have given a lesser included instruction in this case.
Well, if the issue in this court's mind comes down to whether Strickland prejudice can be shown in these circumstances, I think no reading of Strickland can categorically makes a rule that there's no Strickland prejudice when counsel fails to request a lesser included instruction.
In fact, if we were to adopt the state's position, counsel would automatically be ineffective for requesting a lesser included, because under the state's analysis, either you committed the greater crime or you'd get off, because the jury's never going to... I mean, the defense counsel requests a lesser included, it must be given. And yet, under the analysis that the jury would never acquit them of the more serious crime and convict them of the lesser one if... Basically, under the argument, as I said, that the state's making, you're saying if the jury didn't believe all the elements of the of the greater crime, they'd never convict him of it, and so then they'd acquit him of all crimes. It would really be ineffective for counsel to ever request a lesser included, because they'd be making it more likely that you'd have a conviction.
I agree.
And yet we say that you have to give it if counsel wants it, if it's allowed. So it's really inconsistent with Missouri's approach to this issue of lesser included.
I agree. The case cited by the state applies Florida law, and I think it's at odds with Missouri. And to say that Strickland doesn't allow any speculation, I don't know if I'm answering Judge Fisher's question. All PCRs involve some degree of speculation. There's a.
But all we're here talking about here is actually just having a hearing, is what
that's
we're talking
right.
about. And the question, it could be, that's what you discern about a strategic. You may think that the defendant might say they've been overcharged. So if you give a lesser included, they might get convicted of that, whereas they might beat the higher charge.
Right.
But it's still a strategic choice, and all you're asking for is a hearing.
All we're asking for a hearing, the motion court denied a hearing, presuming that that trial counsel's decision not to request a lesser included was a trial strategy. They rested it solely on a presumption.
Is that a proper presumption?
I think Strickland talks about presumptions, but importantly, it talks about the reasons for presumptions. It talks about presumptions are necessary primarily, I think, to guard against the distorting effects of hindsight. In a post-conviction case, in an amended motion where a hearing hasn't been held, where counsel hasn't testified as to his or her reasons for not doing something, I think over-reliance on a presumption is not consistent with Strickland's opinion.
Would you prefer the flip side of that, that in order to get a lesser included offense, your client has to take the stand and say and negate some element? Because isn't that really your choices? We have a system where all you got to do is not present any evidence and hope they don't believe it and ask for it if you want, or go back to an era where if you want a lesser included offense, you have to present some evidence to negate some element.
I think I'm jumping around a little bit, Your Honor. I was answering about whether a hearing is a relief we're requesting.
I think Judge Wilson's question was directed toward whether or not we should presume it was a trial strategy question.
I don't think you can rest solely on a presumption. I think
if the law is you're entitled to get a lesser included merely by asking for it, why wouldn't we presume?
Well, it's not merely by asking for it. There will be some circumstances where a lesser included instruction won't be mandated.
If the facts would support it and you request it, our law is you have to.
That's right. So,
but under Williams, where the jury is entitled to not believe all
right.
part or none of the testimony, doesn't that essentially mean if you want one, you get one?
Well,
you don't have to present any evidence.
But your
there is a case saying, I think it was Jacob overruled one of these cases, I think, Childress, to the extent that the defendant was required to present affirmative evidence of the negation of an element. No, that's not required under this court's decision in Yakov.
And there have been cases where counsel said, I just forgot, I didn't do this in other situations.
That's right. And importantly, the state here argues or suggests, although I think Mr. McElprang would somewhat concede there's no indication of counsel's strategic reason for not doing what he did. The state does go on to suggest that most likely counsel was employing an all-or-nothing defense. He was reasonable in that sense. But an all-or-nothing defense and under the circumstances of this case would be unsound.
Because he was a persistent offender, and by being convicted of a felony burglary, he has a much stiffer penalty than if he'd been convicted of a misdemeanor trespass.
Right. At trial, he confessed, admitted fully to the jurors his guilt to the misdemeanor stealing. It would be unsound to then not request a B misdemeanor, which would carry a maximum of 6 months, and leave your client on the hook for a
felony. Does the jury know what penalties come with these, and that he's a persistent offender?
No, the jury doesn't know that, but I mean that needs to be a decision. It needs to be a reasonable decision to not request that instruction. With court, discussing that with Mr. McNeil, there's no evidence that he did. The amended motion originally alleged that had Mr. McNeil known, he could have. requested that, he certainly would have.
And we know the jury was concerned about this issue here because they asked, did he have to form the intent before or after he entered the apartment?
That's right. And there, too, I think Strickland's, rather than a categorical rule denying prejudice in all cases like this, Strickland never wavers from the idea that the prejudice prong is shown through a reasonable probability that the outcome, but for the mistake, the outcome of the trial would have been different.
But his own testimony was that he knew she didn't live there anymore before he walked across the threshold, before he walked into the apartment. He knew it was no longer her apartment. That's what he said.
On transcripts 234, 235, he indicated up until the point he opened the door and stepped in, he believed Tracy lived there.
I opened the door up. Hey, Tracy, but now I'm in shock. It's empty. I step in there.
Well, there's, I think, page transcript 181 or something. He also says, I open the door and I'm in at the same time. So there's, you know, there's some ambiguity about that.
But even if he knew she didn't live there, it's only burglary if the only reason he went in there was to steal.
It's burglary if the only reason...
if he had the intent to steal.
Right. The argument is that he didn't form the intent until he was already inside, which would not be a burglary.
Well, suppose it had just been a vacant... The Tracy never existed and the door was open to an apartment they were renovating. Would the jury be entitled to presume that... or to conclude that that he had a burglarious intent from the fact that he went into this place he had no right to be in otherwise and stole something and ran out down the hall?
Well, it's, I mean, there's cases, Hintze, Hintze involved, and I'm about to be out of my time, somebody who goes into an unlocked door, but that's 3 a.m. in the morning. His reason ostensibly was to use the bathroom in the middle of the night, 3 a.m.
I don't think you're saying there wasn't a submissible case on burglary. You're saying but the jury had a choice to try to figure out his intent. Their question shows they were focusing on the issue of his intent when it was formed, but he was clearly guilty of something, and the only thing they were given to convict him of was the greater offense. They weren't given an alternative.
That's absolutely right, and had they been given that alternative, there's a reasonable probability they would have convicted on that alternative. Thank you, Your Honor.
You may have been jumping around a bit, but that's the nature of our argument.
Thank you.
You asked a lot of questions. Thank you.
May it please the Court.
Go ahead.
The question of whether counsel can be ineffective for failing to request a lesser-included offense should be resolved in the negative because you cannot show Strickland prejudice. The Florida Supreme Court has indicated that you can't have Strickland prejudice under those circumstances. The 11th Circuit has indicated that in one of their opinions. The lower federal district court indicated that in their opinion. Our Western District Court of Appeals has recognized
that. When would
that.
Effective counsel ever ask for a lesser-included then under your analysis?
Well, I think that...
Because the jury's never going to get to it.
Yeah, you have to separate the performance prong from the Strickland prong. And in Strickland, they said, when you are looking at prejudice, and I will answer your question, I'm not trying to dodge it. When you look at prejudice, you have to divorce the analysis from speculation, caprice, whimsy, nullification, those sorts of things. Although those things may play a role in strategic decisions by counsel, they are irrelevant for the prejudice analysis. And so
you're saying for strategic decisions, counsel may think the jury has an alternative. They might choose not to convict them. And yet in the prejudice prong, we have to ignore the reality of what jurors may think?
That's exactly right, Your Honor. In making strategic decisions, I think that all of us recognize the possibility of jury nullification or the jury pardon, that it exists, that sometimes jurors will, just through their own prerogative, give a more merciful or lenient verdict than what the evidence supports. And that's a reality that I think none of us can ignore in terms of just the practical, everyday way that the world works. And Strickland acknowledges that in terms of the performance prong in counsel's decision-making. For example, if counsel is going to tell his client to choose between having a bench trial or a jury trial, you can think about whether you think that the judge is going to be better at following the law or the jury is going to be following the law. But under the prejudice analysis, they should both be equal because we should presume that whatever decision-maker is working in the case is going to act conscientiously and follow the law. But as a practical, strategic decision, you might tell your client, look, I think under these circumstances, we'd rather have a judge. Or under these circumstances, we might have a jury. Pardon me.
We have the rule of law, and I think it's in ineffective assistance cases, where we find there's no prejudice, or maybe it's in direct appeals, we find there's no prejudice when there is one lesser included submitted and they are found not guilty.
True.
Or they are found guilty of
yes.
the higher crime. Mm-hmm. So in those cases, it is significant that they were given the option of finding guilty of a lesser included offense. So walk me through the analysis where we found they had a choice.
Sure.
And they made the choice. Here you're saying we shouldn't require that there be that choice to find they weren't prejudiced.
Right. And the reason, the difference for the analysis is simply the language in Strickland, which establishes that there is a presumption that must be accorded to the jury in doing the prejudice analysis. But here, and Sanders talks about that difference, why we have that presumption and follow it under Strickland and don't on direct appeal. And one reason for that is the issue of finality. Once a criminal conviction becomes final after direct appeal, the judgment has been affirmed, the verdict has been upheld, the interests of finality attach. In a collateral situation, in a collateral attack, those interests of finality remain. And the question is, do we then undermine that and allow an attack? Now, on direct appeal, when there's no other alternative, I think courts have indulged that practical reality that there may be a divergence from the theory that juries follow the law and the practice of what juries do in the deliberation room. And I think that's part of our analysis on direct appeal. But in those cases where the jury has been given two choices and they select the higher choice, our appellate courts and this court has said, in those circumstances, we can say beyond a reasonable doubt that their verdict was firm, that they were firmly convinced because, look, they had another option and they didn't take it.
But why doesn't that analysis go further in this case to say we can't have that belief, that firm conviction, because they didn't have another option?
I think simply because of Strickland. Because Strickland says we presume that they were firm and that they followed the law. And we will presume that they acted conscientiously. And thus, we will presume that their verdict was guided by the instruction which said, you can only enter this verdict if you are convinced beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, one could argue, by extension, that a similar presumption should be applied on direct appeal, and that we shouldn't second guess the jury's verdict on direct appeal when a lesser included offense instruction has not been given. Now, but of course you don't have Strickland's presumption, and you're looking at different sorts of claims on direct appeal than you are in a post-conviction setting. In post-conviction setting, it's ineffective assistance of counsel. We have a set rule. We have an established rule from the United States Supreme Court that says these are the principles. On direct appeal, it's not a question necessarily of whether counsel is ineffective. That may be a theme that's underlying somebody's thinking when they're looking at it on direct appeal. But you have procedural due process. You have the right to present a defense. You have other freestanding constitutional rights and statutory rights bestowed by our Missouri statutes on direct appeal, which, when they're not followed...
Strickland doesn't limit your rights as defense counsel, though. It sets a floor. And I don't know if I agree or disagree with your interpretation of Strickland, and the court will look at that issue, of course.
Sure.
But if this court on direct appeal feels it's appropriate to look and see whether... where you had a right to a lesser included and it was not given, and we find that error, we certainly have the right to do that in post-conviction also. Why should we have an inconsistent practice between those two?
Well, I think that this court has recognized the difference between direct appeal and post-conviction. I didn't cite it in this case, for example, but the court in Maynard versus State overruled the Western District to the extent that it had applied a direct appeal standard in a case involving juror misconduct. On direct appeal, if there's juror misconduct, there's a presumption. There's you can't do harmless error analysis. But this court in Maynard said, we're not going to import that direct appeal standard into the post-conviction standard.
And I'm not saying in every case, but here where you have the jury asking about this very issue, isn't this the kind of case where you might find a reasonable probability the jury would decide differently?
And that's not illogical, Your Honor. I agree. And if the court wants to adopt a standard that provides greater protection than what Strickland says, for example, I think that that's always within this court's prerogative to provide more protection than what the United States Supreme Court has outlined for the protection
that's
of constitutional provisions.
That's the minimum requirements that courts must.
Yes, the Strickland represents a minimum test, and I think that if this court wants to go beyond Strickland, it could, but I think that it won't be based on Strickland.
Counsel, it sounds like your argument is that we can there will never be an evidentiary hearing in a claim like this, and the fear is going to be on the other side that we're always going to have them in a claim like this. Is there a way to split the difference, and maybe just at the suggesting the fact that the jury had a written question provides enough daylight to split the baby there if possible?
I see where you're coming from with that question, and I have, I guess, a couple of responses to that. I'm not sure that if the court applies Strickland's prejudice analysis, that there is a way to split the baby. I don't think that these claims can be successful.
Is a jury question really a jury question, or is it one juror's question?
Well, we don't know. And
Could have been 11-1, and then the person thought about it and went the other way.
Yeah, it's true. We don't know exactly what that means. But one thing I think it means, and quite contrary to what the defendant argues in this case, is that the jury was perfectly capable of considering whether he had the requisite intent, regardless
or
of whether...
Or maybe the jury wondered why that evidence was offered.
Perhaps.
But wouldn't there be certain circumstances, and maybe this is one of the cases, where trial strategy can't be presumed? I mean, it's a very logical that it would have benefited him to have the lesser-included instruction, and maybe an evidentiary hearing and this type of fact scenario is appropriate to flesh out whether or not it was trial strategy.
With regard to the first prong and counsel's trial strategy, I think it's somewhat easy to surmise what counsel's strategy would be, but I agree, Your Honor, that in light of the allegations in the amended motion, it can't be presumed because he probably alleged sufficient facts to overcome the presumption, at least for the first prong, but not for the prejudice prong. And getting back to one other thing about Judge Wilson's question with regard to the jury's question, when they ask that question, it clearly shows that they're capable of considering in their minds, does he have the requisite intent? And the
but they had nothing to do with that. If they thought he didn't, but they thought he clearly committed a crime,
they could have found him not guilty.
Then pardon me. I think what would have happened in this case if they thought he was not guilty, first of all, under Strickland's presumption, I think that they would have rendered a not guilty verdict. But if we want to indulge in the possibility that they were nullifying and convicting him anyway, even though they didn't think he was guilty, I think what they would have done was found him not guilty of the burglary offense and simply found him guilty of stealing. In fact, they had a third option in this case, even though it wasn't on the first count. It was on the other count. If they were truly convinced that he did something and we got to get him, but we don't think he committed burglary, well, then what they would have done, if we're going to indulge in these sort of practical realities of what juries might do or might not do, they would have just found him guilty of the other submitted misdemeanor of stealing. But they didn't. They found him guilty of both, which I think shows a pretty reasonable probability that they actually thought he was guilty of both crimes.
You have told us that there are a few courts, Florida, 10th Circuit,
11th Circuit, pardon
me, district courts, that have ruled the way that you're arguing us to rule. Are there other courts that have ruled to the contrary?
I looked a little bit at that, and I found a case, I think, out of the Third Circuit, Brake Iron versus Horn. Forgive me if I've got the circuit incorrect. And they applied an analysis somewhat like the analysis that that the defendant would want us to have, which is to say, look, we know what the theory is behind what jurors do, but practically speaking, there's always a risk that, in fact, they weren't convinced, but they didn't want to let him walk free, so they found him guilty of the one offense that was submitted to them. And to reach that analysis, they rely on Beck versus Alabama, which is a different United States Supreme Court case. And in Beck, the court said, hey, you know, in this capital case, you've got to give the jurors another choice, because if you don't, there's a risk that they're going to think, man, this guy, he did something really bad, and we only have one choice, and if we don't convict him of this, you know, he's going to walk, and he's a really bad guy. And so the United States Supreme Court said in Beck, you've got to give him a second choice. And but here's a critical difference. In Beck, they were dealing with direct appeal. And so the standard has always been a little bit lower on direct appeal in determining prejudice from errors by the court. It was not a claim of
ineffective. And yet it recognizes jurors may not exactly follow that instruction. And so
true.
Why do we close our eyes to it later on in the process?
I think because the United States Supreme Court in Beck recognized that in a direct appeal situation where the instruction had been requested, but was unwilling to recognize, or excuse me, they didn't address it in Strickland. But, I think
that's sort of a different, I mean, I understand there's different levels of prejudice that you show, but you're saying we can say this presumption is not all-encompassing on direct appeal, and yet in post-conviction say the presumption can't be touched, and that doesn't make sense to me, but the presumption that irrebuttable or it's not.
Well,
for all purposes.
And whether it might be a rebuttable presumption, that might be a question. I mean, but Strickland says you're not entitled to the luck of a lawless decision maker. You're not entitled to rely on speculation, whimsy, caprice, nullification, mm-hmm. the idiosyncrasies of a particular fact finder. You've got to presume.
But you can't do that on appeal either.
Well, except that on appeal, the court expressly did do that in Beck.
Well, but maybe what this is not that. It's not presuming. It's just recognizing that the jurors are going to look at all the different submissions and pick the one they think you're guilty of.
Yes, except
an order of consideration is not the same thing as jury nullification.
No, I agree, Your Honor. And if only trespass had been submitted in this case, for example, I think there's no doubt. There is a reasonable probability that he would have been convicted of trespass. I know this because they issued a verdict on the greater offense, which includes all of those elements. They found them beyond a reasonable doubt. But that means they also found beyond a reasonable doubt that he entered with the purpose to commit a crime therein. And under Strickland, which is, I think, distinctly different from Beck, and I think that, you know, in Strickland they weren't looking at lesser included offenses, and so it's a question whether they would carry forward that presumption from Strickland into a case such as this. But under Strickland, we're supposed to presume, at least according to their language, that the jury would not have entered that verdict unless they made that factual finding beyond a reasonable doubt.
There seems to be an assumption here that the court would have had to give this lesser included if it had been requested. Is that, do you concede that, or you want to drop a number there?
I do not concede it, and I did brief that aspect of the case in my brief.
Do you have any cases after State versus Williams, though, that supports your argument?
Well, I do think that this court's more recent pronouncement do cast some doubt on Hinsa, which is the primary case that I rely on, and it was the primary case that the motion court relied on.
Because we've said the jury can believe some but not all.
That's
well,
correct.
It's not necessarily what we say. That's what the instructions say on the MACR regarding lesser included offenses.
Well, I can't remember what the notes are.
MAICR 3rd 304.11G, which was relied on heavily in the Williams case, basically takes the standard from the other cases that the jury, just like the judge, is entitled to believe all, none, or part. And the instructions on use say, if requested by a party, that the judge has to give any instruction based on the legal theory. And if that assumes that the jury cannot believe any element of a crime, then that assumes basically that upon request that a lesser included offense instruction is mandatory in basically every case.
I think
we're requesting.
I see that I'm out of time, and I don't know if that requires a response, Your Honor.
I'd be happy to.
Your Honor, I believe that that's certainly the direction that our case law in Missouri has been heading. And I think in times past, we used to have the so-called automatic submission rule that the court then backed away from for a period of time. And frankly, maybe moving back towards that direction of automatic submission in cases at least where it's requested by a party. And if that's the case, so be it. And it may be that this would be a situation where counsel's performance, you know, could be said to fall below an objective standard of reasonableness unless counsel had a specific strategic reason to avoid asking for it. You know, and in this case, I think that it's not difficult to see why counsel might say, hey, I'm better off trying to go for the acquittal on this burglary because the only way they're ever going to, the jury's ever going to acquit or to convict him of trespass is if they believe my client's testimony. But if they believe my client's testimony, they're not going to convict him of burglary anyway. So I'm going to stay away from it.
But that's speculation. And if he has a hearing, we'll know whether the attorney thought that or didn't think
that. That's correct, Your Honor. In term, and of course, that applies to the first prong of Strickland as opposed to the prejudice prong, where I think that counsel, you know, has to make those sort of nuanced decisions. But at this point, we don't know because there hasn't been an evidentiary hearing.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Briefly, Your Honors, I would point out options do affect decisions. So between Judge Stiss and Judge Fisher's kind of dialogue there, that they were sure that he was guilty of something, so they would have just convicted him of something versus acquitting him. I think when a jury is given kind of different instructions, it drives a dialogue and discussion between the jurors, and it can lead to, during the process of the deliberations, discussing up and down the different charges and which one is correct based on what's submitted to them.
Have you found cases that are contrary to the cases cited by the state regarding Strickland's presumption that would be no prejudice?
I don't think Strickland, there's no case. Strickland, I think the state is incorrectly reading of the presumption of no prejudice. The state is taking a paragraph from Strickland saying that the jury, you're to presume that the jury didn't act arbitrarily or capriciously, I think, and you're not entitled to a luckless decision maker. We're not asking for a lawless decision maker. We're asking for an informed jury, a jury and decision maker.
Are there cases around the country that have found that an attorney was ineffective and prejudiced for failure to request a lesser included offense?
Yes, and this state has ever since the Strickland opinion has under the Strickland's guidelines has, without a categorical rule, resolve these types of cases, and they're usually resolved by concluding that the evidence was overwhelming and therefore the lesser included instruction would not have made a difference, therefore he wasn't prejudiced.
We look at the prejudice. Are there published cases that do that you discussed?
Yes, there are. State versus Blewett is one of the cases that's both cited in the brief mandating on the issue of the lesser included, whether the lesser included would have been mandated. Also, it's a post-conviction case on this very issue. So this isn't something new to the state of Missouri. It's been considering cases where counsel has failed to request a lesser included instruction. Strickland's overarching test that the movement needs to show reasonable probability that the outcome would have been different provides a workable test. The state's reliance on Florida case law is an opposite to Missouri law. They're two different things, and I'd ask that the court look at the briefs on that issue. And if there are no other questions,
Counselor, in regard to the cases where ineffective assistance has been alleged for failure to request a lesser included defense, were you able to find a case where the court held that the failure to do so was prejudicial? Or are you saying you've just seen cases where they've analyzed the issue of prejudice?
I've seen cases where they analyzed the issue. In most cases, it's not easy to win a post-conviction case. In most cases, I think the court indicated that the evidence was overwhelming. In this case, I would eventually argue that it wasn't due to the jury's questions. Thank you.